Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In 1929, Georgia O'Keeffe and Rebecca Strand left their homes and famous photographer husbands to travel to New Mexico in search of artistic independence. O'Keeffe was established by that time, but often felt constrained by the artistic circle around Alfred Stieglitz. Beck Strand was trying to find her way as a painter in the shadow of Paul Strand's growing success, and in a community that seemed to have room for only one woman artist. Strand had a little sister relationship with O'Keeffe, often dressing and wearing her hair like her better-known friend. During the two summers they spent in Taos, O'Keeffe provided Strand with the support she needed to develop an independent artistic voice and a medium, painting on glass, that she could call her own. For Strand, who settled there permanently in 1933, Taos offered an environment that suited both her swashbuckling public persona and her delicate imagery. In this lecture, held on March 18, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art, Carol Troyan shares how, for both artists, the Southwest offered a space where women artists could flourish.
Here are the members of our sisterhood, Georgia O'Keeffe at left and Rebecca Salisbury Strand at right. Alfred Stieglitz photographed them at his family compound in Lake George, New York, probably in late September 1922. O'Keeffe, who's 35 years old here, and Strand, who's 31, had met the year before through Strand's new husband, Paul, an up-and-coming photographer and protege of Stieglitz's. O'Keeffe, as I'm sure you know, was both protege and muse to Stieglitz. They would marry in 1924. O'Keeffe and Strand, and from now on to avoid confusion with Paul Strand, I'll call her Beck. Everybody did. O'Keeffe and Beck had become acquainted in New York, but that September at Lake George was the first time they'd spent quality time together. The image is a bit of a spoof. The women are dressed similarly with broad-brimmed hats shading their eyes. Their postures and expressions are rather melodramatic. They hold some recently harvested grapes, traditional emblems of pleasure and fertility. It's a satire on sentimental Victorian photography. Here they are again, 7 years later, at the beginning of the greatest adventure of their lives. This is 1929, and they've just made a trip together to Taos, New Mexico, leaving their husbands behind. They are posed more or less as they were in Stieglitz's photograph. But now it's O'Keeffe who seems taller and more in charge. It's her arm that's draped protectively over Beck's shoulders, not the other way around. The summer was critically important to both of them. When they arrived in New Mexico, they were at different points in their professional lives, although a key ingredient of their personal lives was the same. They were both married to photographers of genius. By 1929, O'Keeffe's artistic career was well established. She had already had many shows at Stieglitz's galleries. Stieglitz was equally remarkable as a talent scout, impresario, and promoter of American modernism, and he'd gathered around him many of the brilliant avant-garde artists of the day, photographers like Charles Sheeler, Edward Steichen and Strand, and painters such as John Marin, Charles Demuth, Marston Hartley, Arthur Dove, and of course O'Keeffe. O'Keeffe's paintings were selling well, including her New York skyscrapers and the enlarged flowers for which she's best known. Beck, meanwhile, had artistic yearnings, but was still figuring out what she wanted to do. Her background was artistic, but in the performing arts, her mother was a light opera singer, and her father was the manager of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. She was the youngest of four children, and so she fell as readily into a little sister role as O'Keeffe, the oldest girl of seven children, could naturally take on the part of big sister. When Beck met Strand about 1920, she was thrust into an exciting creative community that demanded involvement in the visual arts. She liked being around artistic people, and wanted to participate in their world. Meanwhile, she was working as a medical secretary. O'Keefe encouraged Beck to try oil painting, and then the even more difficult medium of pastel. By the mid-1920s, she was adept enough to be included in a couple of exhibitions. Unfortunately, almost nothing by her survives from this period, so just as I've shown you two O'Keefe masterpieces, I'll show you one by Beck Strand too, but from a little later in her career. This painting is one of her largest, most ambitious, and most accomplished works, a reverse painting on glass called Bowl of Vegetables. It seems simple and straightforward as its title is, a mundane still life of ordinary vegetables painted in flat, bright colors. Yet at the same time, and I'll come back to this, it's a remarkably sophisticated performance, one that pays homage to a number of artistic traditions and is wittily poised at the intersection of folk art and modernism. As we'll see, it would take Beck a long time and a lot of anguish to get there. Through the 1920s, she struggled to find her own creative voice, a quest that was no doubt complicated by her husband's success. Paul Strand, as you can see, was a handsome, romantic figure, quiet and thoughtful, just a year older than Beck and already quite a presence in the New York art world. He had won acclaim for his photographic abstractions and won prizes for his images of New York. He had had exhibitions at Stieglitz's 291 gallery and elsewhere, and he had won the approbation of Georgia O'Keeffe, a tough critic. They met in 1917, and as she reported, he showed me lots of photographs and I almost lost my mind over them. Strand soon became Stieglitz's principal mouthpiece and cheerleader. He was also, and this is kind of weird, Stieglitz's proxy. O'Keefe had been to New York in 1917 and met Stieglitz, with whom she'd already been corresponding for a year. She then returned to her teaching job in Texas, but became ill in May 1918. Stieglitz sent Strand to press his suit with O'Keefe to urge her to move to New York. Trouble was, Strand was deeply attracted to O'Keefe himself. They had been corresponding, sometimes passionately, for the previous year, and some of the attraction, I think, is apparent in this photograph Strand took of O'Keefe that spring. Meanwhile, Stieglitz, his father figure, is pursuing her too. Ultimately, Strand concludes and writes to his mentor, "I'm not the one," and he escorts O'Keefe back to New York and to Stieglitz. O'Keefe and Stieglitz moved in together in 1918 and began dividing their time between New York and Lake George. Meanwhile, shortly after Paul met Beck in 1920, he began photographing her, obviously inspired by and in an Oedipal way, competing with the photographic portraits of O'Keefe that Stieglitz had begun about 1918. The two sets of photographs were very different. Though Strand made some nudes of Beck, he focused primarily on her face, you see two here, seeking to record different aspects of her personality and her beauty. They are quite intimate, capturing the uneasy balance between confidence and vulnerability that was the essence of her personality. Stieglitz's images of O'Keefe, on the other hand, were at once portraits of Georgia and a photographic essay on the subject of woman with a capital W. So she appeared as both individualized personality and iconic type. The photographs explored every aspect of her body. At the same time, O'Keefe, who was much more self-assured than Beck, determined how she would face the camera as much as Stieglitz did. She was complicit in Stieglitz's project and presented herself in a variety of guises as seductress, clown, dancer, poet. Strand never exhibited his photographs of Beck. O'Keefe Stieglitz showed his of O'Keeffe, including the nudes, at the Anderson Galleries in New York in 1921. They caused a sensation and made her relationship with Stieglitz quite public. At the same time, two of Stieglitz's acolytes, Paul Rosenfeld and Marcin Hartley, published essays on O'Keeffe's art, interpreting it almost entirely as a reflection of her sexuality. So suddenly O'Keeffe is really out there as an artist, a muse, but also as a sexual object. Meanwhile, her friend Beck had caught Stieglitz's eye. In September 1922, the Stieglitzes invited the Strands to join them at Lake George. Paul was on the road and couldn't go right away, so Beck went on her own. The two couples had become a tightly integrated foursome. They were bound together by admiration, competition, shifting alliances, affection, and not a little sniping. It got more and more complicated, as one of O'Keeffe's biographers has noted. Stieglitz soon began to insinuate himself into the Strands' relationship. He'd already been corresponding with them separately. His letters to Beck are often flirtatious, those to Paul somewhat paternalistic. Then at Lake George, he began a series of photographs of Beck, which we can't help but assume were designed to upstage those of his protege. Writing to Paul, Stieglitz called Beck a thoroughly live wire and a much more pliant and vital model than O'Keeffe. He called the resulting images eye-openers, you betcha, but not only because of the subject's lack of inhibition. Rather, her lively personality inspired photographs that were looser, less formal, more snapshot-like than anything Stieglitz had done before. They indicated a whole new way of working. Stieglitz and Strand were competitors now, both professionally and personally, the women far less so. Stieglitz and O'Keeffe went on to make some really significant work in the period that followed, but not the Strands. For the next several years, Paul made relatively few photographs. And for Beck, maybe it was the photo sessions with Stieglitz, who knows, but they ultimately proved a distraction from her artistic development. While lavishing attention on her with his camera, Stieglitz also made it clear he didn't think much of her talent. He declined to show her work with the excuse that it would look odd for him to promote Strand's wife when he was already promoting Strand. But behind her back, he said, Beck, as nice as she is and certainly developing, does lack creative seeing. But if Beck's relationship with Stieglitz was problematic, she continued to find O'Keeffe supportive. O'Keeffe urged her to persevere and follow her instincts. And O'Keeffe's own work was an inspiration. As Beck wrote to Paul, Georgia has been painting every day and has done nothing but apples. Each one is better than the last. The apple paintings, as well as some Lake George landscapes and a group of great organic abstractions, were included in the large retrospective of O'Keeffe's work that Stieglitz organized in 1923. The show was a success, but also painful for O'Keeffe, since Stieglitz, who knows why, decided to reprint in the exhibition brochure the essay by Hartley that was full of sexual innuendo and Freudian views of her pictures. He talked about her, quote, shameless private documents with their unqualified nakedness of statement. O'Keeffe almost wept, she said later. This is typical of Stieglitz, I think, promoting and patronizing at the same time, encouraging O'Keeffe's work, but making it hard for her to be heard as she wanted to. Shortly after O'Keeffe's exhibition, Stieglitz put on a show of his own work. By this time, O'Keeffe had begun to withdraw from his camera, as one scholar has put it, and so there were only a few photographs of O'Keeffe's and some of Beck in the show. What caught everyone's attention this time were his new and revolutionary photographs of clouds, which he called equivalents. Now, by this time, Stieglitz and O'Keeffe were passing artistic ideas back and forth. Stormy skies over Lake George led each of them to create an abstract, rhythmic, brooding image of undulating shapes. She painted her image of darkening clouds in response to his photographs. And he called this photograph Music, a title he borrowed from the abstractions O'Keeffe had painted a few years earlier. But if Stieglitz and O'Keeffe were stimulated by one another's work, there was also competition between them, a competition most obvious in their images of New York. Stieglitz and his acolytes considered his photographs of New York, this is City of Ambition from 1910, they considered them to be the ultimate representation of the modern city. They made it clear that O'Keeffe was a painter of nature, of flowers and plants and other female subjects. But the city, well, that was a subject for men. This was her proud response, a series of paintings of skyscrapers that she began in 1925, shortly after she and Stieglitz moved into the Shelton Hotel, one of the many multi-story buildings springing up in Midtown. Radiator Building Night is perhaps the best known of O'Keeffe's New York pictures. Designed by Raymond Hood, the Radiator Building is an Art Deco take on the Gothic style, an elegant, streamlined black structure with crenellations tipped in gold. In O'Keeffe's interpretation there on the left, this majestic new building is both physically dominant and magically, magnetically attractive, glowing from within. It combines electric light and starlight and orbs of illumination from street lamps. The painting pulses with energy like the city itself. It presents the Radiator Building as an emblem of New York triumphalism, at once a great iconic Gothic sculpture and a futuristic machine. With all its nuances and multiple allusions, it's arguably more compelling than any contemporary image of New York by a man. It also contains a private joke, O'Keeffe's response to Stieglitz's declaration that she couldn't possibly paint New York. The joke is contained in the flashing neon sign at the left of the building. It actually said Scientific American, but O'Keeffe changed it to read Alfred Stieglitz. So she makes the painting a tribute to him, but she's also thumbing her nose at him a bit. By including his name, O'Keeffe suggests an analogy between Stieglitz the seer, the mesmerizer, the revolutionary, there he is in that guise in a self-portrait on the left, an analogy between Stieglitz and the building, a symbol that of all that is innovative and transcendent. She's honoring him, but at the same time, she's looking him dead in the eye and saying, your name may be on that building, but I put it there. Just look at what I can do. This is the moment when O'Keeffe really began to assert her independence. Working hard at her own art, she began to feel confined at Lake George. So she went off on her own to paint. She began to see herself as a leader at this point. In 1926, for example, she addressed the convention of the National Women's Party in Washington, here. And taking a page from Stieglitz's book, she began promoting younger artists, mostly women. In the winter of 1927-28, O'Keeffe organized a group exhibition at the Opportunity Gallery, a nonprofit space dedicated to presenting work by emerging artists. Two-thirds of the artists in that show were women, including Helen Torr, and I'm showing you a Torr on the left. And in April 1928, O'Keeffe organized a second show for the Opportunity Gallery, this one a solo show of paintings and drawings by her close friend, Rebecca Strand. Beck's show, That's a drawing by Beck on the right. Beck's show was a modest success, and she must have been cheered by this comment from the esteemed critic Henry McBride. "Seeing her work," he said, "makes one want to see more." But the months that followed Beck's show were difficult for both women. Stieglitz, now over 70, had developed significant health problems and demanded constant attention from O'Keeffe. He worried about the fate of his intimate gallery, since the building it was in was up for sale. And he was becoming involved with Dorothy Norman, a beautiful and wealthy young woman who was a daily visitor to the gallery. Meanwhile, the Strands' marriage was falling apart. Stieglitz provided a simple, telling diagnosis. She is finer without him, he finer without her. O'Keeffe, too, commented about their essential incompatibility. "They were not meant to live together," she said. "Rebecca was a very lively, lean young woman, and Strand was thick and slow." Clearly, both women needed a break. In late April 1929, without their husbands and without much of a plan, they left for New Mexico, which each had visited briefly several years earlier and found overwhelmingly beautiful. They traveled by train via Chicago and arrived in Santa Fe on April 30th. Almost before putting down their bags, they hopped on a bus and went to see the celebrated corn dance at the San Felipe Pueblo, which was about 40 miles southwest of Santa Fe. And when they got there, they ran into Mabel Dodge Lujan, an old friend from New York, who reprimanded them for not telling her they were coming west. Lujan insisted that they stay at her compound outside of Taos. Mabel knew everyone who was anyone in the avant-garde cultural scene, east and west. By this time, she's about 50 years old and on husband number 4. The first two provided her with lots of money, enabling her to establish salons, first in Florence, where Gertrude Stein came from Paris to visit her, and beginning about 1912 in Greenwich Village. By 1916 or so, she and husband number 3, the painter Maurice Stern, had traveled west, and by 1918, they had decided to settle in Taos. She then ditched Stern in favor of Tony Lujan, a Pueblo, you see him there, and started an art colony. Among her guests were the writers D.H. Lawrence, Robinson Jeffers, and Willa Cather. There were musicians and dancers, Leopold Stokowski, Martha Graham, and there were painters. Marsden Hartley was the first of the Stieglitz Circle artists to arrive. He loved the landscape, but was overwhelmed by the tumultuous environment at Mabel's, or as he warned his friend, and this works better if you read it, he wrote it in a letter, "Taos is another way to spell chaos." Mabel put O'Keeffe and Beck in the pink house. That's it behind them on the right. Another guest described it as nothing special, a small building with a wooden porch overlooking an alfalfa field. O'Keeffe called it the finest studio I ever had. There is very little that doesn't seem quite perfect here. Perfect except for the constant comings and goings of the bold-faced names. Among those they met were the Harlem Renaissance writer Alain Locke, the Mexican caricaturist Miguel Covarrubias, and the young Ansel Adams. John Marin, that's one of his watercolors of New Mexico. Marin came in May and made great watercolors there. But even among all those high-strung, self-dramatizing personalities, O'Keeffe and Beck stood out. They looked alike. They were similar physical types, and they wore their hair in the same severe style. They often dressed in matching outfits and shopped for clothing together, often buying the same things, as O'Keeffe wrote to Stieglitz. "We both have brought back excuse me, we both have bought black workman shirts for 95 cents. I have four strings of white Indian beads to break the front. Beck has bunches of blue hearts. O'Keefe at this point sometimes felt a little competitive with Beck, so she wrote to Stieglitz, "I'm much tougher than she is, and she seems to tire sooner than I do." But usually she was supportive and affectionate. "I think very nice things are happening to Beck here," she said. For her part, Beck described their relationship as idyllic. "It's almost as though she had a schoolgirl crush on Georgia." She wrote, "Georgia and I have a beautiful relationship together and feel the need of nobody else. In fact, we get ugly if anybody joins us that we are not crazy about. Nobody can ever take this mutual sharing away from us. I think she is perfectly happy with me, for she speaks all the time of getting a large car next spring and are going off together. We also have in mind trying to find a little house somewhere near New York that we can retire to when we feel like it. I am entirely myself in her company." Nice things were happening to Beck that summer. At Taos, she was seen as competent and independent. Soon after they got there, Mabel became ill and handed over the running of her complicated household not to O'Keefe, but to Beck. Beck also enjoyed having no restraints on her behavior. As a friend remembered, she was much involved with the frontier types, the cowboys, gamblers, cattle rustlers, makers of Taos Lightning Whiskey. Yet despite these distractions, she came into her own as an artist there, mastering her very taxing medium of reverse painting on glass. Beck had begun painting on glass the previous fall. She said O'Keefe, who used a glass palette herself, inspired her to try it. O'Keefe herself never worked on glass as a support. It became Beck's signature medium, however, another marker of her growing independence. Now, reverse painting on glass is incredibly difficult. You first make a drawing on paper, then place a sheet of glass over the drawing and trace it onto what will become the front of the completed painting. Color is then applied to the back. The medium requires you to think in reverse. Images have to be turned backward in your mind, and pigment is applied in a sequence that's the opposite of normal. That is, the highlights, the ornamental details, they need to go on first, and then the broader planes, and finally the background. But it can be worth it. At its best, the work is luminous, transporting, somewhat otherworldly, an effect enhanced by the simple, iconic shapes and pared-down compositions that Beck preferred. O'Keefe, too, had a productive summer. Shortly after arriving, she visited D.H. Lawrence's compound and painted this picture on the left, which she called the Lawrence Tree. According to her sister, it was one of the big pictures she made in Taos, showing a pine tree and millions of stars. She is sitting under the tree, looking up to paint it. It's O'Keefe's first real homage to the Southwest, celebrating the vastness and clarity of its spaces. At the same time, it reflects her ties to the East and to Stieglitz. She was torn, as I said, between her obligations to Stieglitz and her obligations to her own work, and he wasn't making it easy for her. Soon after she arrived, he sent her some equivalents, like the one at the right, to remind her of him and of home. And in fact, this painting, The Lawrence Tree, is also an equivalent, but now entirely on O'Keefe's terms. Like the photographic equivalents, it has been shown in a variety of orientations as O'Keefe intended. It was done, she said, so it could be hung with any end up. But no matter how it was hung, she told Beck, it looks as though it is standing on its head with all the stars around. In Lawrence Tree, O'Keefe presented a kind of stark beauty, and limitless, unfettered space, unlike anything she'd found in the East. It was a place with which she had special, liberating communion. Looking back on that summer, she could have been speaking for Beck as well as for herself when she said, "I realize I am different than when I came out." She also described it as one of my best painting years, and indeed it was. In fact, it was such a good summer for both women that they determined to return, and so by late April of 1930, the Sisters of the Traveling Palette were on the road, heading again for New Mexico. They started out at Mabel's, but O'Keefe soon fled the chaos and went to El Calde, about 40 miles southwest. She'd stayed there with another friend, Marie Garland, and in the comparative calm of that place, painted a series of stately, idyllic landscapes. Beck stayed in Taos, although she and O'Keefe often made trips together. She taught O'Keefe to drive, and they both enjoyed the freedom the car gave them. This may have been the summer that O'Keefe shipped to New York a barrel full of bones she had scavenged in the desert. She began painting the bones at Lake George, and the resulting pictures combine careful description with an unsettling monumentality. The artificial flowers O'Keefe put on the painting at left called Cow's Skull with Calico Roses, they were probably inspired by Beck, who the previous summer had bought some in Taos and used them in her glass paintings, like the one on the right, because of what she called their pure, clear, white beauty, but also because of their spiritual associations. Native women use them to decorate graves, and so they have a connection with both life and death. And although O'Keefe and Beck were working in different media and on a different scale, they shared an interest in centralized, frontal, close-up compositions in which ordinary objects take on a strange resonance. O'Keefe showed her New Mexico images at Stieglitz's new gallery, An American Place, in 1930 and 31. Critic Henry McBride praised them for their elegant shapes charged with solemn mystery. By this time, Beck felt confident enough of her work to send one to Stieglitz to sell in his gallery. When he couldn't find a buyer for it, she gave it to him. Shortly after that, Stieglitz offered the Strands a show. He had never given Beck an exhibition and hadn't shown Paul's work in more than 3 years. In any terms, the show, which opened in April 1932, was odd for a Stieglitz production. There was no catalog, and Stieglitz was nowhere to be found during the installation. Beck and Strand hung it themselves. Strand showed 100 photographs. Beck's 20 paintings on glass were consigned to one of the smaller rooms. Stieglitz's promotion of Strand's work was minimal and of Beck's non-existent. It seemed that most of the reviewers didn't even find their way into the back room. When they did comment, they tended to dismiss her paintings as decorative, a term and not a compliment frequently used to describe art by women. Beck did find a supporter in Elizabeth McCausland, a perceptive critic who understood the complex heritage and profound spirituality of her seemingly simple works. Her pictures, McCausland wrote, framed in antique Mexican tin frames, set the keynote for the union of the strange and the familiar that is particularly striking in Mrs. Strand's work. Painting on glass is an old New England art, while her images are very much a part of New Mexico and that queer sense of otherworldliness that New Mexico creates. To see the photographs and the paintings together will be to see two expressions of the impact New Mexico makes on the artist. Unfortunately, the exhibition marked the end of the Strands' togetherness. After the show closed, Paul and Beck went west to try to salvage their relationship, but soon separated. They got together one last time in the spring and summer of 1933 in Mexico, where Strand was working, but the marriage was irreparable. By August, they had divorced, and Beck returned to Taos. She and Paul, this is really sweet, marked the end of the marriage by gestures of affection. He wrote the brochure for her December 1933 exhibition at the Denver Art Museum, saying, "There is much room in this world for songs as well as symphonies, for lyric as well as epic. In these songs can be heard a distinct response to object with which she has made a true and loving contact." And she made one of her most poignant glass paintings in tribute to him. She called the work Paul, and it is a portrait of him and of the warmth that still existed between them. She chose an 8x10 inch piece of glass, the size of one of his photographic plates, and except for the red heart, hung like a charm on the bracelet, and the green sprig, a symbol of eternal love and friendship, the work is entirely in photographer's black and white. The shell was an early and treasured gift from Paul to Beck, and their initials intertwined are linked on the heart. O'Keefe returned to Mexico the next year, 1934, and stayed at Ghost Ranch, about 50 miles west of Taos. She fell in love with the landscape, and the paintings of her surroundings exhibit a new expansiveness. She went back to Ghost Ranch nearly every summer after that, buying property there in 1940. This is, in fact, at the bottom there, her house. Behind it is the Pedernal Mountain, a feature of so many of her works. O'Keefe moved to the Southwest permanently in 1949 after Stieglitz's death in 1946 and the settling of his estate. Though they lived some distance apart, O'Keefe and Beck remained in touch. When, in 1936, Stieglitz invited Beck to exhibit again at an American place, O'Keefe helped her choose 30 works for the show, possibly including this one, White Hollyhocks from My Garden, and then escorted them east. But then Stieglitz decided to use only 11 of the paintings, and rather than giving Beck a solo show, he included her in a group show with Marin, O'Keefe, Hartley, Dove, and Demuth. While Beck expressed delight to be in such good company, she was admitted to the Stieglitz circle at last. She knew her work was relegated once again to the smaller room with the big names out front. O'Keefe tried to console her by telling her how nice her paintings looked in the gallery's clean white room, and explained that there wasn't much publicity for anyone. The town is so full of big shows. What little recognition Beck got was dismissive. Her work was characterized as some small decorative paintings on glass by Rebecca Strand, wife of Paul Strand, photographer, and as chiefly floral with a hint of O'Keefe. That Strand was seen in the shadow of her husband is a curse familiar to women artists. When a woman marries a man of equal talent, she invariably loses out. The comparison with O'Keefe may also have been inevitable. There were a number of women artists like Beck associated with the Stieglitz circle, but as my friend, the noted scholar Wanda Korn put it, O'Keefe was the only woman granted full membership. In her early years, Beck sometimes measured herself against O'Keefe, noting wistfully, "I feel so discouraged when I see her neat paintings." Yet she regarded this comparison as a corollary to their sisterhood. O'Keefe was her protector and mentor, and Beck never seems to have resented her success. How fair and illuminating is the comparison with O'Keefe? It's true that O'Keefe was the pioneer in identifying subject matter, painting flowers and crosses before Beck did, for example. But in the Southwest, all the artists seemed to gravitate toward the same subjects. The Rancho de Taos Church, for example. Here is Ansel Adams's photograph on the left, and Paul Strand's at right, and John Marin's watercolor at the bottom, all made around 1930. O'Keeffe's painting there on the left celebrates the building's formal dignity, its inherent organic abstraction. Beck's treatment of the subject is quite different, emphasizing the piety of the women moving toward the church and the cross. It is solemn, ritualized, and laden with emotion. O'Keeffe probably inspired Beck to paint surface-filling, looming flowers. And O'Keeffe's, that's an O'Keeffe on the right, are far more dramatic, far more assertive than Beck's. Beck's, on the other hand, have a shy, tender reticence, a deliberately old-fashioned, even primitive quality. Mabel Lujan described them as having a frail elegance and inconspicuous delicacy that is the antithesis of the large, unembarrassed flower forms with which O'Keeffe startled the world. The art of the two women was surprisingly different from their public selves, for in life, O'Keeffe was the more reserved one, and Beck the thoroughly live wire. Beck's flower subjects could also be remarkably pared down and austere. Simple, gracefully contoured shapes with only the most elemental modeling and the flat planes of pure, radiant color give images like this one an almost hallucinatory quality. Here's another theme they shared. O'Keeffe had begun to paint crosses her first summer in New Mexico and created a fascinating hybrid of still life and landscape, bringing together near and far, iconic and infinite. By 1934, Beck was painting crosses too. One of her most complex reverse paintings on glass is this image of a Campo Santo, a cemetery, with its handmade wooden crosses. It is solemn, displaying a kind of primal innocence, and seems to express the entire history of the region. While O'Keeffe's image is somehow triumphal, Beck's is tender and sympathetic. Another feature of Beck's work that I think sets it apart from O'Keeffe's is its magical, visionary, even hallucinatory quality. We see this in some paintings on glass she did of shelves starting in the mid-1930s. This painting on the right, showing a shell against a relatively featureless background of sand and blue sky, is on a 2x3-inch piece of glass. It nonetheless seems monumental, and the shell itself seems unnaturally, even ominously large. O'Keeffe painted shells too, of course, and that's one on the left, but here I think Beck's touchstones was not only O'Keeffe's abstracted naturalism, but also another artistic idea. In January 1932, the art dealer Julian Levy put on the first show of surrealism in New York. Over the next years, interest in surrealism grew, culminating in the exhibition Fantastic Art, Dada, and Surrealism at the Museum of Modern Art, one of the big shows in town when Beck's work occupied the back room at an American Place. I'm showing you Dream Landscape by Yi Tanguy, it's at the top, a major figure in the movement. I think the deliberate ambiguities of scale, the precision, the sense that, as with the Tanguy, we're looking at a dream landscape, are qualities that Beck's work shares with those cosmopolitan, highly cerebral, and technically brilliant painters. In tiny, exquisitely crafted, hauntingly luminous pictures of a shell in the desert at right, or an elk's tooth as big as the sky? Beck seems to have dipped her into her subconscious to bring us Talismans of the South work. Beck really flourished in the 30s and 40s. During those two decades, she had five solo exhibitions in Denver, Santa Fe, and other Western cities. Critics in the West didn't see her in the shadow of Paul Strand or Georgia O'Keeffe. They were free of the Stieglitz mystique and respected her independence. Her show at the Denver Art Museum in 1933 was hailed as one of the most original and altogether individual exhibitions. Her lyrical paintings conjured up a world of infinite implications. No one called her paintings decorative. Instead, they were understood as representing, quote, forms and feelings which may seem naive and primitive, but which in reality are quite otherwise. No wonder she chose to remain in the West. Divorced from Paul Strand and settled in Taos by the fall of 1933, she soon found an anchor for her personal life in William James, a local banker and rancher she would marry in 1937. They promenaded together through Taos's civic life and the society pages of its newspapers. The press especially liked her flamboyant dress and personal style. Here's a description of her from the Albuquerque Journal. She wore black cowboy boots, blue denim breeches, and a black and gray checked shirt. On her head was a black slouch felt hat. Her hair is silver, but her face is young. From a corner of her mouth, a cigarette dangled. A picture from the Parisian Apache Quarter, yet one of the more sophisticated of the Taos women. Another newspaper article gets at the contradictions of her personality. She rides her horse to a lather, talks tough, associates with gamblers, yet enter her house and you are in a precisely ordered, almost lace-doilied world. Taos was a place where independent women were the order of the day. Beck was not only the queen of Taos society, she was also taken seriously as an artist, as seriously in her own milieu as O'Keeffe was in hers. For the last few minutes of my talk, I'd like to go back to one of Beck's most complex and revealing works and think about it alongside one of O'Keeffe's. They've a lot to tell us about how these two members of the modernist sisterhood expressed their understanding of the Southwest and how they saw themselves as artists. This painting, now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, is perhaps O'Keeffe's best known work. It was painted in New York from one of those bones she had shipped back from New Mexico. In 1938, Life magazine did a feature on O'Keeffe in which this photograph appeared with the headline, "Georgia O'Keeffe Turns Dead Bones into Live Art." The story describes how O'Keeffe brought her beloved Southwest back east, and in her paintings of bones and skulls, went about creating a new set of icons for American art. Or, as she described it, "As I was working, I thought of the city men I had been seeing in the East. They talked so often about writing the great American novel, the great American play, the great American poetry. So as I painted along on my cow's skull on blue, I thought to myself, I'll make it an American painting. They will not think it great with the red strips down the side, red, white, and blue, but they will notice it." Among many other things, this painting is both an icon and an argument against East Coast macho provincialism that was the Stieglitz Circle. It's an image that can't be explained by reference to her sexuality, her gender. The image is forceful, insistent, a gesture of independence, even defiance. On the other hand, Beck's painting brings East Coast and even European traditions to Taos. from a woman with black cowboy boots and a dangling cigarette butt lace doilied home comes a gesture of domestication. Her subject is a plain ceramic bowl brimming with produce. It is inscribed, "For Jane and Rick, happy many things, but mainly happy home." In other words, like a homemade casserole or a plate of donuts, it was a housewarming gift for new neighbors and also a punning representation of one. The vegetables were deliberately chosen. They are sturdy onions and carrots, radishes, turnips, celery. There are no fancy or exotic species, just the humble bounty of a kitchen garden. Her choice of the ordinary reflects the 1930s determination to find beauty in the commonplace. This principle was behind many of the still lives of the era, from Charles Demuth's exquisite watercolors such as red cabbage, rhubarb, and orange on the left, to the series of hand-colored lithographs in a folksy idiom, this one is vegetables, created by the regionalist George Grant Wood. But the antecedents for Beck's imagery are not just found in the work of her own era. Such bounteous still lives presented in formal frontal arrangements and simple settings and painted in bright, unmodulated colors are an important part of the American folk tradition. These images, known as theorem paintings, were often painted on velvet. The artist relied on stencils to provide parts of the design. The artists who produced these images were most often women, and, like Beck, were self-trained. Beck was well aware of this tradition. She owned a number of 19th century still life watercolors and called one of her reverse paintings on glass, this is it, New England Still Life. Her signature medium also had roots in folk art. Rural self-taught painters in Central Europe began making small paintings on glass in the mid-18th century. Immigrants from this area brought the technique to America, where until the middle of the 19th century, folk and decorative painters produced reverse paintings on glass. These were sometimes separate objects and sometimes were installed as ornamental panels or above mirrors or other articles of furniture. Beck's interest in painting on glass was also part of the larger modernist movement to find inspiration in the primitive. The medium was revived in the 20th century by such artists as Gabriele Münter, Wassily Kandinsky, and Franz Marc, working in Bavaria, where folk painting on glass was an important part of the local artistic heritage. Kandinsky, in particular, and this is a Kandinsky, saw in these naive glass paintings a model for expressing the universal religious myths he sought to express in art. And in America, there was a burst of enthusiasm for the medium about 1916 to 18. Artists as dissimilar as Rockwell Kent on the left and Marston Hartley on the right made works on glass during this period. Their impetus came from their enthusiasm for folk art. In its deliberate primitivism, Beck's work was closest to Hartley's. They'd met in Maine in the summer of 1928, but she hadn't seen his glass paintings before she began working on glass herself. A few months later, in 1929, he wrote to warn her off the medium. He said, "Now, if you are attempting to paint on glass, I can only say pax vobiscum, for it nearly killed me, and I never had the courage to take it up again." Beck knew well the difficulties of painting on glass. "Images have to be reversed mentally," she said. "The technique requires infinite patience. Once the paint is dry, there can be no changing. There can be no slip between idea and execution." In some cases, for example, Elk Tooth and Magnolia, she worked with simple designs and that called for a minimum overlapping of forms. But in other images, she created eerie atmospheric spaces where forms seem to both advance and recede in a kind of mystic promenade, as we've seen in Edge of Campo Santo on the right. Her best work is characterized by a combination of delicacy and strength, innocence and sophistication that adds to their intrigue. Of the still lives Beck painted during this period, Bowl of Vegetables is distinguished by its subject and its presentation. She created many floral still lives, but images of fruits and vegetables are rare. More significantly, most of James's other still lives appear against a blank background. Here, however, she placed her vegetables on a defined ground plane with curtains behind so that they appear to be on stage. She had used drapery backgrounds before, and there is a long tradition in both vine and folk art of using drapery swags and in portraits to convey the dignity and prestige of the sitter. But here, with subtle humor, she used draperies to impart dignity to an outsized bowl of vegetables, which take on human scale and stand before heavy red curtains as though about to take a bow. Beck, now one of Taos's leading ladies and at the height of her technical and creative powers, takes on the roles of both impresario and virtuoso. Like its creator, Bowl of Vegetables is both dramatic and domestic. In it, the artist has turned a charming, homely image, the perfect housewarming gift, into a tour de force of visual theater. This, then, is the story of the Sisterhood of the Traveling Palette, how two women make their way to the Southwest, where they find confidence, mature artistic voices, independence, and humor. We have long recognized O'Keeffe's surpassing achievement, her transformation of American modernism through her dramatic injection of the poetry of the West. The quieter, radiant contribution of Beck Strand, her close ally and friend in the Sisterhood of the Traveling Palette, deserves to be better known. Thank you very much. Charlie says we can do questions if you have any. Oh, good. Yes, please.
Where can we see Rebecca Strand's work?
The question is, where can we see Rebecca Strand's work? Well, good luck. Much of it is in the Southwest. The ones that I've shown you, the beautiful little Four Paul is owned by the Fogg Art Museum. The Campo Santo there on the right is at Yale, and that's about it in public collections in the vicinity that I can think of. You don't have any. Bad. Anybody else? Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.